Oscar Gamble, a major league corner outfielder and DH from 1969 through 1985, died this week at the age of 68, and all the coverage seemed to come down to his afro, which famously appeared on the baseball card that first depicted him in airbrushed fashion in a Yankees uniform. He had been traded from the Indians to the Yankees in November of 1975. In a pretty good deal, the Yankees sent a starting pitcher, Pat Dobson, who had one good year left in his career, while Gamble would be a weapon for them on and off for the rest of his career. And the afro was huge and unusual, even for that time, and it looked weird puffing out from the sides of a batting helmet. And it seems utterly consistent with both those times and the afro that Gamble owned a disco called Oscar Gamble's Players in his hometown of Montgomery, Alabama. And you can just kind of imagine both the haircut and the suit that goes with it. It seems like something out of Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights, except that in this case, the proprietor of the club is not played by the great Luis Guzman, but by Oscar Gamble. But the thing is that shortchanges him as a player. Gamble had his limitations. He was not a great defender, and he had some platoon issues. Unlike a lot of left-handed hitters, he didn't disappear completely against southpaws, and he had very good plate judgment, so he still got on base at a decent clip. But his power, which was so pronounced against right-handers, more or less disappeared. He just had no pop at all when facing a southpaw. It's like he was just trying to hang in there and make contact. And again, in that way, maybe he might have been playable if he was a better defender, but he wasn't, so you didn't have to. And when the conditions were right, he would kill the ball. He wasn't the most consistent player in the world. And there's this blemish in the middle of his career where he signed in the first blush of free agency. This is similar to the Wayne Garland or Richie Zist contracts I was talking about last week. He signed a 6-year deal with something like 15 or 20 years of deferred payments with the San Diego Padres heading into the 1978 season. And what the Padres needed with a DH, I don't know. But in any case, he played decently for them, and when you look at his stats on a park-adjusted basis, he was okay, but he also hit only 7 home runs. In fact, he slugged .387 overall, which was not what they were expecting. And so he got shipped off to the Rangers rather directly, and thence back to the Yankees. He had left the Yankees in the first place, and this is a footnote to a whole lot of neat baseball history, because the early pass at free agency when it first came in was so convoluted. Each team had to pick names off a list that they wanted to negotiate with. It was like a draft just to talk to them. And the Yankees had selected, among others, Bobby Gritch and Reggie Jackson. And Billy Martin, who had gone to the 1976 World Series with Gamble as his right fielder, didn't feel like they needed Reggie Jackson. He would have been happy to go forward with Gamble. And the Yankees would have preferred to have Gritch because they needed a shortstop. And although he had been a great second baseman for the Orioles, they felt like he could move over and play short. Well, we'll never know if Gritch would have been capable of playing short on a regular basis. He came very close to signing, but in the end opted to go home to California and signed with the Angels. And the Yankees then turned to their second choice, who was Reggie, who said yes. Well, now they have an overage of players and they still needed a shortstop. And it turned out that Bill Veeck, who was in his second stint of owning the White Sox at that point, was so broke and so worried about his own free agent negotiations with shortstop Bucky Dent that he was willing to make a swap. This is right on the verge of opening day, so that he could actually like pay people to open up Comiskey Park and let the fans in, like sweep the aisles and pop the popcorn. And so Gamble and a prospect, Lamar Hoyt, it was almost Ron Guidry, but general manager Gabe Paul told George Steinbrenner over my dead body, and $200,000 went to the White Sox for Bucky Dent. And the rest, as they say, is history in terms of the 1977 championship and, of course, that famous, or depending on your perspective, infamous home run by Dent against the Red Sox in the 1978 playoff game. But ultimately, Gamble finds his way back to the Yankees, and he's kind of a platoon slash pinch hitter guy for the rest of his career, because at that time, when pitching staffs were smaller, the Yankees were carrying, I'm not exaggerating, 8 or 9 outfielder DH types per season. And so at-bats were hard to come by. But in very specific situations, like against right-handers at Yankee Stadium, he was a killer. For his career, he hit .285 with a .383 on base and a .585 slugging at Yankee Stadium in 750 career at-bats. It's a homer every 12.5 at-bats. If you imagine one full season like that, let's say 550 at-bats, that's 44 home runs. And if you didn't know that the circumstances for him to compile those numbers had to be absolutely perfect, right park, right pitcher, you'd think that he was a guy, based on those percentages, that if they had just let him play every day, he would have hit 300 or 400 home runs in his career. As it was, he hit exactly 200. I talked to Gamble exactly once. This was at a Yankees Old Timers Day many years ago. I found him sitting by himself at a locker in the clubhouse, and I walked up to him. He was very friendly and willing to talk, and I said something very similar to what I said just now. I said to him, "When I looked at the back of your baseball card, I always thought that if you just got more playing time, you would have hit 40 home runs some year." His high was 31, so it wasn't a completely mad thought. And he, Gamble, got a big smile on his face, and he looked to his left with that big smile and kind of gestured towards me. And then he looked to his right with that big smile and gestured towards me again as if to say, "You hear what this guy's saying? You hear what he said about me?" But there was nobody there. So he just went, "Yeah, I thought so too." And he stood up, big grin. He didn't have the afro then. This was many years after disco and the afro had gone out of style. He's wearing these tiny little glasses, so small that I couldn't quite figure out how they served any purpose. His eyes were much bigger than the frames. So I was a little distracted by that. And we just talked for a few minutes about how he was platooned, and I said, "Do you feel like you could have hit left-handers?" And he said, "I thought I could." And of course he would say that. As I said before, it wasn't totally true. And I don't think the conversation contained any great revelations in any sense. It was just a pleasant exchange. And at the end of it, I thanked him, and he thanked me, because I think he was still happy about what I had said. In this life of ours, and particularly as it relates to baseball, there's a lot of cruelty that goes around, and everyone has sat in the stands and booed at some point, and some of us who are less empathetic or can't hold their beer have done worse than booed, said things to players that they wouldn't dare say if they were face-to-face with them, but they hide behind the anonymity of crowds. They do it online now, not just in the ballpark. The opportunity to demonstrate kindness to a player is unfortunately much rarer. And Lord knows that in my capacity as a pundit and an analyst, I've said mean things about players too. Most of them are not personal. Most of them have been restricted to pointing out that a team might be asking a player to do something he's not suited to do, or say rely on somebody like Alcides Escobar to hit leadoff. And that's fair, but it doesn't necessarily feel good because I've got nothing against Alcides Escobar the person. And in the case of Gamble, most of his career happened before I was aware enough to really appreciate it. I caught him mostly at the tail end. And even then, as in 1984, when he was 34 and averaged only .184, but popped 10 home runs in 125 at-bats and took 25 walks, he was still really good. Just again, in that very specific niche sense. But I didn't really know him as a player, and I hadn't really rooted for him in any explicit sense, except again to appreciate that back of the baseball card with those cool home run percentages. And he didn't know me, but for that brief few minutes that we spoke together, he seemed really happy, and I think I made him feel respected and appreciated. I will never forget the expression on his face just going from an indifferent, "Yeah, you can talk to me," to this big grin. Somebody believed he could have been a 40 home run man in the majors. "Yeah, I thought so too. Whatever else good or bad I've done in my life, at least I know I was responsible for that one kindness." Rest in peace, Oscar Gamble. I'm Stephen Goldman, and this is the Infinite Inning Baseball Podcast. lecture hall late and you're lucky to get a seat. Professor Wincock is a world-renowned expert on spiders, and it's not every day he unveils a new species. As you settle in, he's already on stage, speaking before a shrouded glass container. An assistant stands nearby. "I found them in the jungles of Tasmania," he said. "A new, unique species, very dangerous, preys on human beings. They have incredibly forceful jaws, such that can even sever a human limb. Evinrud, if you would." Evinrud, with a flourish, pulls the veil away from the container, and you can see two large black objects visible to the naked eye, even from your seat in the rear of the auditorium. "We are calling them Atracini phalanges. We have two specimens here, a male and a female, which my young daughter has christened Chip and Dale. Dale is the female. As you can see, they are black, 12 inches in diameter, with a very attractive rainbow pattern on the thorax. But it's their predatory strength that is truly impressive. Evinrud, if you would." Evinrud shakes his head. "No." "Come, dear boy, we've discussed this." "No." "Come now, or I will terminate your scholarship." Evinrud shuffles reluctantly forward to the edge of the cage. "Your hand." Evinrud extends a shaking hand. Wincock grasps it by the wrist and inserts it, fingers first, into the cage. "Now we will place Evinrud's fingers before Chip, and you will see how he reacts. Ah, yes, he's getting the scent of it. Here he goes." Evinrud screams. The woman beside you gets up, holding her hand to her mouth, about to be sick. "Now, as to Dale, the female, they are much more vicious, much more dangerous. They can do far more than break fingers. They can break..." "Where is Dale?" "Dale?" "She's not in the cage. Where is Dale?" And as the audience runs out of the auditorium screaming, as you look down and see a large black object climbing slowly up your leg, jaws snapping back and forth in pincer-like fashion, you realize that your interest in spiders is grotesque, and that your interest in dangerous spiders, to the exclusion of all else, may be the reason you don't have a date for this evening's performance, and that you would have been better off inviting a friend to stay home with you, sit before the fire, and listen to episode 40. And you can feel good about one thing: though you may lose a body part tonight, spiders really are an ecologically beneficial species. Welcome back to the show. I hope you enjoyed this week's journey into my subconscious. This is the world I live in. I just tend to extrapolate worst-case scenarios about everything. This may or may not be psychologically healthy. I leave that judgment to you and perhaps my shrink. The cool thing is, neither of you can do a damn thing about it, and neither can I. This week, I am joined by Cliff Corcoran in his usual spot in the rotation. And since I was honored with a spot on Brian Kenny's MLB Now show on the MLB Network this week, a show that Cliff is a veteran of, we give you a little look behind the scenes of that production, and then we turn to current events such as they are. Probably like last week's show, by the time I get this one online, the Brewers will have traded for Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and Joe DiMaggio, and everything will be dated, but we kicked around a number of interesting topics, including Mark Appel's leaving baseball for a while, Yu Darvish's free agent destination, and the retirement of longtime player, manager, and coach Davey Lopes, who had a really special career. Before I roll Cliff out here, I want to clarify one thing that we talked about that has always bugged me, but I didn't get to work it into the conversation. In discussing Appel, Cliff rattled off the very short list of first overall draft picks who failed to make the major leagues. One of those legendarily busted picks was catcher Steve Chilcott. In 1966, the Mets had the first overall pick in the draft. By popular acclamation, the top draft prospect in the country, and this is not retroactive, if you look at the primary sources at the time, this is what people were saying, was outfielder Reggie Jackson, who was starring at Arizona State University, playing center field and hitting like Reggie Jackson, except with 300 averages. Parenthetically, as Bill James points out, if he had spent the prime of his career somewhere other than the Oakland Coliseum in the early 1970s, he probably would have hit some 300s in the major leagues too. But be that as it may, he was a top prospect. Chilcott was a prospect also. He is mentioned in the pre-draft coverage as being a player of interest, but he was a very different player. He was a 17-year-old playing at Antelope Valley High School in Lancaster, California. His senior year, he went 42 for 84. That's 500 if you're not good at math. Had 6 triples, 11 home runs. He looked really good. The Mets looked him over, decided he was their guy, and on June 7th, at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York, they called out his name, which let Jackson fall to the A's at number 2. Chilcott did make it as far as AAA, barely. Most of his career was spent in A-ball, and his numbers are not horrifyingly bad, but we'll never know what he might have been because he injured his back right at the beginning of his pro career, and apparently he was never the same. Still, Jackson was a Hall of Famer, and observers had correctly first guessed what he would be. So, ever since then, there have been competing explanations offered for why the Mets had screwed up so badly, and these fall into 2 or 2.5 schools of thought. One, offered by Reggie himself, was that he was dating a white woman or a Mexican-American woman, and the Mets, who were run by George Weiss, the legendarily racist general manager at that time, just didn't like the idea of having someone who dated interracially on their roster. So it was pure racism that led to Reggie falling to the 2nd overall pick. The Mets have always denied this, and they've denied it in 2 ways. And again, when I say the Mets have denied this, many people, or all of the people involved in this selection, are dead at the present time, and so this is one of the few things wrong with the Mets that you can't blame on the Wilpons, who weren't anywhere near the franchise at that time, except perhaps geographically. Their explanation is twofold, and one I sort of accept, and one, and I do have kind of a rooting interest here, really bugs me, because it's a cover-your-ass kind of thing. The explanation, I believe, is that they drafted for need instead of for talent, which is something you're never supposed to do in the draft, and instead of taking the best player available, they took a catcher because they wanted a catcher. It does seem plausible that a confirmation bias could be at work in that decision. You know you need a catcher. You see a catcher as one of the more talented players in the draft. It's very easy to convince yourself that your needs and the talent rankings align. The draft was relatively new. Maybe they weren't thinking clearly. This has never been the best managed organization in baseball. So, sure. The one I really dislike, though, is the one that begins, "Casey Stengel told us to." And that's where my rooting interest comes in, as a Stengel biographer and someone who just likes to keep the record straight. Stengel was 76 years old, was retired. He wasn't the team's manager anymore because he had fractured his hip. And he felt that he could not go out to the mound with a cane. So he had gone home to California, and since Chilcott was a California player, they asked him to take a look at Chilcott. Once. You sometimes see this rendered as Casey Stengel scouted Chilcott and filed a glowing report. Not so much. He saw him in 1 game. He went 4 for 4 that day, which is great, but even Casey knew that a 4 for 4 on one particular day does not indicate anything about a player. In fact, there's a great story that Hank Bauer used to tell about Casey benching him midway through that kind of game because he figured that Bauer had reached his quota. And I will tell that one in more detail some other time, because the version that Bauer liked to tell does not exist in the factual record. The Mets put out a statement in Casey's name right after the draft. They quote him as saying, "One look is enough for me. This boy has all the tools to become a major league hitter." Well, great. Nobody talks that way. Casey didn't talk that way. No baseball man thinks that way. And, according to news reports at the time, and I quote from an AP story, others in the Met organization who took a gander at the youngster this season were scouts Burbank, Dee Fondy, and Bill Kelly, Director of Player Development Bob Cheffing, and Bing Devine, assistant to President George Weiss. So, no, it wasn't just Casey's endorsement. It was a committee decision in which he played some small part, but because he was the most famous of the group, and because that group of people didn't have the guts to stand by their own judgment, possibly racist though it was, they blamed the old guy who was living out his sinecure in Glendale. If the decision wasn't racist, and if Stengel's opinion was so important to the Mets, then where is the account of Stengel going out to Arizona and scouting Reggie Jackson? They don't seem to have asked him to do that. And whatever anyone thought of Chilcott, Casey included, you can't make a fair evaluation as to whether he's the best talent in the draft without seeing what else is on offer. It's really quite gutless. A few years ago, the Hall of Fame put a boatload of scouting reports, old ones, on their website, and you could look through and see what teams had thought of various players at different times in their careers. And when that went live, the very first thing I did was go to their search engine and enter in Mets and Reggie Jackson, because I wanted to see if their pre-draft scouting report was there. I wondered if there was any smoking gun that said, yeah, this guy's a great player, but he's not the kind of personality, the kind of boy that we would want on our roster, on our fine, morally upright organization. And you know something? There were Reggie scouting reports there. The Mets one was absent, and I don't know if they didn't have it, if they hadn't gotten around to putting it up, or they were covering for somebody. Last note on this before we get to Cliff. 2 years later, the Mets had the first overall pick again, 1968. They took shortstop Tim Foley, one of the worst hitters of the post-war era, if not all time. He hit 251, 283, 309 in almost 1,700 career games. That's Al City's Escobar country, except it's the bad part of the country. It's the rundown nuclear waste dump part of the country that's been strip mined and all the native species are dead. The Yankees drafted fourth that year. They took Thurman Munson. He was the catcher you were looking for, guys. He was right there, and you missed it. Having gotten that out of my system, we'll take a break from a word from our sponsors. As usual, I caution you that the sponsors may not actually appear, and you will have 5 seconds of soothing winds with which to contemplate the errors of your existence and mine. And then I'll be back with Cliff Corcoran. Lacking a head of his own, he stalks the darkened streets of the city, looking for human heads on which to place his collection of baseball caps. Don't let him take yours. He's Cliff Corcoran. How are you, Cliff?
I'm doing well. You wouldn't happen to be 7 1/4, would you?
3/4. I have a huge head. It's a genetic thing. It's
a pretty good noggin right there, yeah. I used to think I had a big head, but I've been looking in the mirror lately, and I'm thinking it's shrinking. I don't know what that's about.
Encephalitis? I don't know. That doesn't sound good.
It's the opposite.
I do worry, though, that if I'm ever asked to play Batman in a major motion picture, that given the size of my head, it's just not going to look right.
That's a lot of cowl.
It keeps me up at night. Like, what am I going to do if Ben Affleck calls and says, Steve, I am giving up the mantle. I need you to take it over.
I understand where that can keep you up. That's very stressful. That's a lot of weight to have to bear.
So I wanted to share this with you. As you know, I did the MLB Now program with Brian Kenny on the MLB Network for the first time this week, and I will say publicly what I said privately to you, which is you, having done that show many, many times, your tips as to what to expect went a great way towards relaxing my tendency towards nervousness and anxiety, and it was a great experience. They were all very friendly and supportive, but I screwed up in one minor way, and in a way, nobody who responded to the show on Twitter or anything, or the producer for that matter, or Brian Kenny said anything bad about this, but Ron Darling noticed it. As you know, that they not only wire you up with a mic, but they put an earphone in your ear so that the producer can talk to you throughout the show and let you know what's going on, when you're going to commercial break, whose turn it might be to talk, the studio's on fire, run for your life, anything like that. And he was a little quiet, and I don't know if that was intentional or just, you know, the audio to my earphone was not great. So I could barely hear it over the other guys talking. So when he was, you know, about to say, okay, we're going to finish the segment, I just hear very quietly, okay, we're going to finish the segment. And I didn't miss anything, but it just made me a little nervous that I would. As we were coming to the end of the show, they were very gracious, and they said, Steve, you can have the last 30 seconds. One of the other guys said, if you have a little extra time at the end, I'd like to get like one last word in. So I had that in mind too, that like I really needed to shave it to like 20 seconds. In the rush to prepare for the show and the many, many topics, as you know, they prepare more topics than they actually end up covering, and they discard some along the way depending on how the rest of the conversation goes and how much time it takes. I hadn't really timed what I was going to say. Like, I thought I could get it in 20 seconds. As we go to that last segment, the producer says in my ear, he said, "Steve, you've got 30 seconds. I'm going to be counting it off in your ear." And I said, "Okay, but I can't hear you very well. So just, you know, scream." And it was kind of a joke. It wasn't wholly a joke, but it was kind of a joke. But he took it very seriously. And so as I begin my remarks, which were about the slow winter, it was an expansion of something that I'd said on the podcast last week about how baseball used to know that they learned by experience that you don't give out 10-year contracts because 10-year contracts will kind of bite you. Now they've figured it out again, and that is supposedly one of the reasons for the slow winter. So 30 seconds goes really fast, and I start talking, and I feel like I get like two words out of my mouth, and I hear 15 seconds, and I jumped, and so I start talking faster, and I say, in other words, 10 seconds. I don't know how it came out on the air, but I definitely felt like it was a little jerky and panicked. And I don't know if I even finished a full sentence.
You definitely finished a full sentence. Yeah, that can be tough. First off, I'll give you a pro tip. And I'm glad that the other tips I gave you were helpful to you. It's certainly, I know in a situation like that, it's very helpful to know what to expect. And the more you do something, the more you kind of learn tricks of the trade. So I'll give you another one. And that is, on the little pack that they put on your belt, there's a volume button.
I didn't know that.
And you can, and neither did I. I used it when the first few times I would go in there, the sound guy would always say, "Is he loud enough in your ear?" And I'd say, "He could be a little louder, he could be a little quiet," and he would adjust it. But I didn't realize that it's really just a volume button that's on the top of the pack. You could just reach behind your back and do it yourself. So I'm always like, "Where's the sound guy? I need this louder in my ear," you know, not really like a child. Like, could you tie my shoes for me or something like that? Because I didn't know. Now it's, you know, I'm just an old pro. I'm gonna lean over and there we go. Now, of course, the trick is that it also raises the volume basically of your earpiece. So you are hearing the other guys on mic in your ear, as well as, you know, you've got the earpiece in one ear and you're hearing them sitting next to you in the other ear. And it can be a little disorienting if you're 2 feet away from somebody talking to them and it's really, really loud in one ear and you're right, not hearing their natural ambient sound as well. So then the producer can be a little quiet, and then they do try to check with you and get that. But yeah, so you can tweak that a little bit. So that's one thing. For all our podcast listeners who want to know what to do with their mic packs, a little speaking about inside baseball. But
I was very nervous about the mic pack because in the past, when the sound guy hasn't come over right away at the end of the show on other things that I've done, I've just gone home wearing the mic pack.
You get the Homer Simpson moment.
It's not like the Naked Gun where I'm being recorded visiting the restroom or that kind of thing. But they do tend to get grumpy when you steal their audio equipment, however inadvertently. So I made a point of saying to the guy, "Get over here after, because I might just leave with it because I'm that absent-minded." But as we finished that bit and everybody's getting up, everybody was very nice. Brian and Dan O'Dowd and Ron Darling were very nice and saying, "Hey, Steve, you did a great job." And everybody was so supportive. It was really cool. But as we were walking away, Ron Darling said, "You learned an important lesson about asking the producer to shout in your ear, didn't you?"
Yeah, it's, you know, and again, it's, I... You know, there's a part of me in the back of my head that, or at least maybe when I was younger, thought, hey, maybe, you know, hosting one of these shows would be a cool thing to do, or that maybe I'd like to do one day. But sitting on that set and watching Brian or one of the other guest hosts on that show or other shows that I've been on actually do it, going from prompter with the producer in his ear, you know, getting all the, you know, the required bumper material and voiceover stuff for the video segments, and then managing the conversation in a way that you're able to participate, but also think about who's getting their turns to talk and distributing that evenly. All the things that are going on in their head at once are kind of crazy and seem so beyond me, having had, like I say, no repetitions having done that. But at the same time, and you know, Brian Kenny used to be on ESPN. He's the veteran's veteran in terms of hosting these sort of programs. But I have seen him on episodes. You would go to commercial and he'll say to the producer, "Hey, you know, you told me how much time there was. I know what that means. I've been doing this a long time. you stay out of my ear because it's hard for me to think and get, you know, wrap it up properly when there's somebody talking in my ear. So even for somebody like him, it's hard to get your points made and sound clean and crisp and organized when there's a producer talking in your ear. So for you, who I know you've done television before, but it's been a while, and, you know, certainly not that level of repetitions, I can only imagine how disorienting it was. And I mean, yeah, you bled into the music and the credits a little bit. It was I could kind of tell that you were squished on time and weren't really getting your thoughts out. But I've done the same thing. That little Now or Never segment at the end can be challenging. And I often find that it's, you know, I kind of warned you about it in terms of having something to say, but maybe I should have warned you about it in terms of the fact that sometimes it can go like that. So, but in general, I thought you did a fantastic job. I think you,
oh, thanks.
I will say that you lucked out with the panel that you were on. I've worked with Dan numerous times and Ron a few times, and obviously Brian, and they're all very, smart and supportive and kind guys, you know, that you know, they will help make sure you get the reps if Brian doesn't, because he's got this thing where he says he likes to go to his right a lot, which is that where Dan O'Dowd was sitting there, that kind of the Ken Rosenthal seat, whatever you want to call it, the analyst seat. But no, I thought it was spectacular. You wouldn't know how long it's been since the last time you've done that, and I hope you get to do it again soon.
Thank you. And again, it was a lot of fun. They were great guys, and they were all supportive. And
yeah, and the thing is that the more you do it, the more you get little less careful about the crosstalk. But, you know, the cool thing about it is, like I say, those guys are good guys. My whole experience as a baseball writer, analyst over the many years, and the reasons why I think this took for me as a career, because I wrote about music before this, and I've worked in publishing, Yeah, as much as you might think, you know, sports in the kind of macho kind of situation that it might be might not necessarily lend itself to it, or this kind of, you know, scouts versus stats, which we've been on one side of it, like you, I'm glad you said on the air there that that's old news, or the idea of players versus, you know, writers like us, no, you never played the game stuff. I have never, in a one-on-one situation with an editor or another player on TV, on radio, felt any sort of animosity from almost, at worst, I've gotten a little bit of indifference from some players who may be a little bit, you know, flippant or whatever. But for the most part, everybody's been tremendously supportive, and there's a level of support and community. And it's not a fighting over scraps sort of thing, even though our industry seems to be shrinking in that way. I've always, and it could be that, you know, it just happened to have the right people in charge that are selecting the right types of person. You know, it's that kind of, there's a clubhouse chemistry aspect maybe, which is a dangerous topic to breach, but I've always felt a lot of support and people lending a hand and helping me be better. And I've certainly felt that in all of my experiences over there. I'm always kind of stunned. You know, the first few times you go in, you think, oh man, you know, I'm going in with the sharks here. This could be dangerous. And it's just, you know, everybody's there to help you out, because ultimately their interest is in putting on the best show, the most informative show. I've been impressed with the network and I say this not as somebody who draws a check from them every so often, but from the moment the MLB Network launched, I've been incredibly impressed with how much their objective just seems to be focused on a love of baseball. You know, it's not about bells and whistles or, you know, any kind of lowest common denominator thing or quick cut highlights. You know, I mean, the whole thing that they do during their highlight show where they'll, you know, like, let's go to the ballpark and sit in for a couple at bats. You know,
I love
it's
that.
Not. Yeah, because they understand that from the very beginning, the network has understood the game in a way that I think no other major sports coverage has, at least not in the past 20 to 25 years. And certainly that ESPN hasn't, not to single them out, but, you know, they've done a lot of the, you know, the game of the week type coverage and Baseball Tonight, which of course is withering on the vine because MLB has been so strong from the beginning. And you see it when you watch it on TV and you see it when you're there in person. They don't do the kind of like reality television style, you know, 8 craziest bloopers in MLB history, where it's like, you know, the blooper lasts 10 seconds and they spend 10 minutes talking about it when it's just like, you know, Tommy Lasorda fell down or whatever. You know, they don't do that kind of thing. But what they did do when the network first went on the air that I wish they would do more of in a slow off season like this is they used to show old games, you know, full old, and not just like, you know, I know the YES Network because we live in New Jersey in that area, and SNY will show great Yankees or Mets games, but they tend to roll out the same ones over and over again. It's Ron Guidry's strikeouts or Dave Rigetti's no hitter or something from the Joe Torre years or whatever. In the Mets, it's often 86, which is fun to watch, but you know, you want a little variety. When the MLB Network came on the air, I watched a game that they showed that was a regular season game between the Pirates and the Expos at Jarry Park in like 1971. Wow. With Ferguson Jenkins on the mound. And oh wait, no, that's not, doesn't make sense. That was a different game with Fergie Jenkins. Fergie Jenkins was one of those. But they that was another one that they showed, though. Was it like a regular season Cubs game with Fergie Jenkins in his first time with the team? The Jarry Park game, you know, Roberto Clemente was in the lineup, and Rusty Staub was the star of the game. And like, it changed. You know, you can look at the stats and see, you know, what Rusty Staub did over the course of his career. And some people would consider him, you know, kind of this Hall of Very Good type of guy. But to be able to see him in his prime, you know, I think he robbed a home run and he got a couple big hits. And I was like, wow, that's Rusty Staub when he was at his best. And he's a guy that's gonna make you tune into a game. But just the idea of seeing a game from Jarry Park, seeing this early Expos thing, seeing Clemente in the lineup and all that sort of thing, just the kind of randomness of it is something that that's kind of what I think a lot of people love about baseball, and the fact that when they first started, they would do things like that. They would put those games up, and I understand that now, you know, they've developed so many different shows that they don't have 2 to 3 hours of space to fill in on a Sunday afternoon or something like that. But then within the shows themselves, you know, one of the recent times that I was on our what's called the A block, the first segment of MLB Now, the topic we led with, the big story, was the Scott Alexander trade. I mean, that was the number one story we had to talk about. And they managed to, you know, pad out the episode with, you know, we gave some Cooperstown justice to somebody. And, you know, the segments kind of fill themselves in as we go along. Bill James showed up.
Awesome.
And yeah, which Brian did a one-on-one with him, much like he did for your book, which, by the way, I thought that was fantastic that he did that to talk to you about Casey.
It was very generous. It was
very much so. And I thought that was fantastic. But I mean, and so I'm sitting there at the desk, and we're talking about Scott Alexander, and Bill James walks in the room. I've never met Bill James before, but I got to meet him there just very briefly. I got off the set, and usually, you know, like you say, that the guys on the set will be, hey, good show, whatever. You know, I've never heard anybody say, oh man, that was a stinker. It's always good show. But I walked off the set, got my mic off, and turned around, and Bill James is out standing right there with his hand out to shake. He's like, hey, good job. And I'm like, so I literally said, Mr. James, thank you for my career.
Yes.
and he just kind of like turned bashful and turned his face away and said, I had nothing to do with it, and just kind of wandered off. So that was the extent of our conversation, because he was then, doing another segment with Brian, pre-taping something for another show or whatever. You know, that's one of the cool things about being able to go into the network. I'll turn around and find myself face-to-face with Pedro Martinez. Or one time I went in to do a segment on MLB Central, which is their morning show during the regular season. I was talking about mammoth home runs. I think Bryce Harper had hit that one. I forget, you know, it went way, way deep, and it was kind of impressive because of the number of things it cleared or what it hit or whatever it was at some point during this last season. So I wrote an article about it, and they brought me in to fill some time, basically. and then I go back into the makeup room to wipe off my makeup, and who pops out of the dressing room but Jim Thome?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I'm like, ah, and he before I can say anything, he again, and this is the kind of attitude, the kind of environment that it is over there, just sticks out his hand and says, hey, Jim, how you doing? And I'm like, oh, hi, I'm Cliff. And I somehow had the gathered myself enough to immediately involve him in what I had just been talking about, because I'm like, hey, you know, we were just talking about you, because we're talking about these, you know, mammoth home runs that may not have been the longest home runs in Major League history, but looked so cool because of where they went. And he hit one, I believe it was to dead center in Jacobs Field, that kind of found the gap between, you know, the bleachers and the stands or something, and bounced out of the stadium entirely. I mentioned that one to him, and he went, oh, yeah, yeah. Did you look at the one that I hit? You know, I can't even remember which one it was that he referred to me to. But so I'm like, I'm talking about mammoth home runs with Jim Thome. This is fantastic. And I didn't even know he was in the building, you know. So that's one of the one of the joys of being able to do that. It's a great privilege.
You know, you and I was talking to David Roth last week too about sometimes you get a little bit jaded about being a professional. Your fandom does wear off a little bit as you get to do this regularly. We've all been in clubhouses, and you know, the first time you definitely have a feeling of dislocation. What am I doing here? I'm just a baseball fan. And I'm sure everybody feels that way the first time. And then after a while, it's work, just like any other job. But there are certain players and certain events and certain people that you get to feeling emotional about. And while I was killing time between segments, they put me in an office, and it was Pedro Martinez's office. All that really meant was I got to be at a desk that had Pedro Martinez's unclaimed mail on it. But it was still kind of cool to be sitting at his desk. And I kept thinking, well, what if he wanders in? What do I do? And he was so great and so charismatic and such an amazing creative. I don't think I'd feel this way about every pitcher or every player, but I kind of thought, if Pedro walks in, is it acceptable just to throw your arms around Pedro? Of course it's not. You know, but I would kind of have that instinct. And similarly, Bill James, as you said, is responsible for virtually everything that's happened in my adult life, however indirectly. And over the years, I've exchanged a few emails with him. We've never met. I know people who are closer to him who are in more regular contact with him, but somehow that's just never happened. And there have been a few times where someone has said, like, hey, Bill James might be in town and we're going to have lunch. Do you want to go? And I'll say, yes, I want to go. But it just hasn't happened. And I think if he walked in on the set as he did on you, I would have been so distracted and so thrown off. I'm sure I wouldn't have done this, but I keep thinking of the scene in Wayne's World where they meet Alice Cooper and they immediately fall to their knees and genuflect, saying, we're not worthy, we're not worthy. Like, I would feel that way. I hold the man in such awe. And, you know, then and now I haven't agreed with everything that he's written or everything that he's said. That happens when you have a reader relationship with somebody over, God, how many years now? But still, what a privilege. I'm actually jealous of that one.
Absolutely. I basically, what I said to him was the equivalent. It was the controlled equivalent of the we're not worthy sort of situation, you know. And the thing is that he walked in on the set when we were on the air, so I was able to premeditate it a little bit. I didn't know if I'd actually get a chance to go up to him, but and of course it's that thing. It was like, man, I hope when this is over, I get a chance to go up and say this to Bill James. And I literally turned around and he was extending his hand to me, you know. So that was just really cool. And but also the thing is that, you know, like you say, he's so important to what we do and the fact that we do, like I said, have these careers at all. He came in, as you know now from having been there, the MLB Central set is actually in the corner of the same studio that they use for MLB Now. So people who kind of come in can come in and be off camera will sometimes just sit on that couch. It's almost like a waiting room inside the studio, and that's what he did. And so he's sitting in the corner of the room, and we do the next segment, which happened to be about the Hall of Fame, and I brought up the Keltner list because I was planning on bringing up the Keltner list, but it's weird to do that with the guy who came up with the thing sitting in the corner of the room, like, you know, like checking his texts or something like that. So And again, the audience at home has no idea that there's the other set is in the room or that he's in the room or anything like that. But I couldn't help but gesture at him and say, you know, Bill James, like, he's right there, you know, was when making my point about Johan Santana and the Keltner list. But that was a very cool thing because of specifically it's not that kind of it's very different than running into a player because, you know, we've all enjoyed these players for their physical performances, and some of them have a personality that entertains us as well. Pedro being one of them. But you know, you run into these guys, and in what we do, if you're in a clubhouse or you're in a studio, and eventually you run into a number of these guys, and it'll ultimately, like you say, it becomes part of your job, and you just have to. You don't quite get the same fan. Like if I ran into, you know, whatever, Dave Winfield or Don Mattingly or somebody when I was 12, I would have lost my mind. But here I'm running into legitimate Hall of Famers, and I'm just kind of, you know, I'm able to play it cool because I've run into other Hall of Famers before, or I've been, you know, on set with John Smoltz multiple times. You know, I'm used to, and not just to single him out, but he's in the Hall of Fame is what I do. It's just part of the job. But it's a different thing when you run into somebody who, had, like you say, has a, such a direct effect, not just on, hey, I enjoyed watching you do a thing, but, you know, because you changed the industry, you made it possible for me to have a job in her, in this industry. And I mean, you know, sure, certainly we would have had other careers if it hadn't gone this way, but you know, it a massive impact on our lives, as much as he might want to shrug it off. So that is a totally different experience, despite the fact that one guy's got 600 home runs and the other guy's, you know, this kind of old heavyset guy from the Midwest who, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think that's the guy that you're just in awe of, because he is who he is and has allowed us to have our lives take these paths.
I'll just close this on one other note that I think about quite a bit, which is that when I did the baseball prospectus book, Extra Innings, More Baseball Between the Numbers, I wrote this long introduction on different stats. And I regretted immediately after writing this, but let it go through for some reason. I wrote a thing on OPS, and I said that OPS plus is stupid, or not OPS plus, just OPS. And the reason that I said that is that it doesn't give you the components. You don't know where it's weighted. So even though on base percentage is much more valuable than slugging percentage in the grand scheme of things, you don't know if a guy has a 750 OPS, whether it's all on base or all slugging. And so you can have two very different players with two very different values have an equivalent number, and therefore it can mislead you. And that's fine. I understand it's a shorthand and that people use it. And I purposely wanted to be provocative when saying that. So far, so good. I don't regret any of that. What I regret is that Ken Rosenthal had around that time written something like OPS is the greatest stat ever. And I quoted that and was highly critical. And I have in my career not attacked a lot of people directly. I mean, if you're Jose Reyes or Aroldis Chapman, yeah, I have. Otherwise, you know what? If you're a ball player that makes errors, people make errors. If you're a ball player that doesn't walk or strikes out a lot or whatever, so be it. That's just skill. It's not you as a person. And I felt very bad that I had crossed that line there. And so that winter at the winter meetings, I made a point of seeking out Ken Rosenthal and saying, man, you don't know me. I feel really bad about this. And he was totally friendly. And he was like, you didn't have to say that at all. I've been attacked before. It's not a big deal. And, you know, I haven't had a follow-up conversation with him since then. I can only hope that he's either completely forgotten about it or that he meant every word that he said. But I expect he would be cool if I did run into him.
Ken is, again, I've been on the air with him a few times and I've had some, you know, conversations with him off the air, and he has a reputation as being one of the nice guys in what, again, I say is an industry that's surprisingly full of nice people. But he's definitely one of those guys who goes out of his way to respond to people, to acknowledge people. I'm sure he probably has forgotten about that, and I'm sure you would have a good interaction with him if you ran into him again, because that's just his personality. As busy as he is, as you know, he's at the top of the heap in terms of, you know, his reporting, and you know, he's one of these guys whose iPhone is basically, you know, crazy glued to his hand because he's constantly checking in with people and getting updates. When Moneyball came out, SI sent me to go see an advanced screening so I could write a piece on it. And Ken Rosenthal, I hadn't met Ken at that point. He was in the screening, and I was like, I should really go up and say something to him, but outside of the time that we were actually watching the film, I did not see his eyes leave the screen of his phone. And I just didn't want to. I'm very, you know, I don't like to interrupt people or get in their way about things, which may be not the best trait for somebody who is to one degree or another in journalism. But nonetheless, I didn't. But I've fortunately had chances since. He's a good guy, you know, in all of my experiences and the experiences I've seen others have with him. Again, it's always surprising to me. Because my experience as a kid in sports, in attempting to play sports, was kind of the opposite. The coaches were jerks. And I shouldn't say that blanket, because I did have one or two coaches in high school that I got along with very well and would be thrilled to see if I ran into them. But, you know, the other kids I didn't get along with real well necessarily. I always felt a kind of a negative, poisonous environment. So to then come around on the other side, and maybe it's because we are on the other side and it's writers and it's the specific players who've decided to have this second career doing commentary. So that's kind of, they self-select on some level for people who play well with others, I guess, or just good at expressing themselves or deep thinkers or whatever. And I'm sure that people will have plenty of examples in which they don't think that's true. But, and again, I said, it's not to a man, it's not everybody, but my experience has just been overwhelmingly positive in terms of the one-on-one, just relationships, communications, conversations that I've had with people on both the journalists and the former players in broadcasting and that sort of thing.
Can it be I like myself, she likes me so, I like myself. If someone wonderful as she is can think I'm wonderful, I must be quite a guy. Feeling so unlike myself, always used to dislike myself, but now my love has got me riding high. She likes me so, so do I.
Steve here, interrupting Gene Kelly in the underrated 1955 CinemaScope musical It's Always Fair Weather. Lyrics by Betty Comden and Adolph Green, music by Andre Previn, to tell you that Cliff and I will be back with a turn towards current events, such as they are, right after these words, or non-words, from our sponsor.
She likes me so, so do I.
When Kevin Goldstein was on a couple of weeks back, he talked about some of the mistakes the Astros had made in their run up to the championship. And one was, he said, we passed on Chris Bryant in the draft. And this morning, there's a bit in the news that the man that they passed on Chris Bryant for, taking pitcher Mark Appel with the first overall pick. Appel subsequently traded to the Phillies. The Astros were able to redeem that mistake by swapping him and a bunch of other guys for Ken Giles. Is taking an indefinite leave of absence from baseball after a series of very rough seasons and getting dropped off of the Phillies' 40-man roster. His minor league ERA at this stage of things is about 5.06. So for a first overall draft choice who is now going to be heading into his age 26 season, that's not real good. And the point that I wanted to make about this and get your feelings on is that at this time of the year, we're also seeing Keith Law, Baseball America, Major League Baseball, Jonathan Mayo, and those guys putting out their top 100 lists and organizational rankings. And it's worth looking at what they had for Mark Appel over the years, because it reminds you to take these things with a grain of salt. Baseball America, pre-2014, this is all via Baseball Reference to give them full due credit. They compile these things. Pre-2014 season, number 39 overall prospect. Pre-2015, number 31. Major League Baseball from 2014, 2015, 2016 had him at 17, 30, and 70. And Baseball Prospectus in those same years had him at 21, 35, and 64. And what strikes me about all those rankings is that when you look at what Mark Appel actually did on the field, they are based on pure belief in his stuff and absolutely almost zero on performance. And so it, as exciting and as fun as it is to see the coming attractions for the future baseball seasons that we're going to get and the future star players that we're going to get, there really is no such thing as a pitching prospect.
No, absolutely. The story that you referred to this morning was by Jun Lee on Bleacher Report, and in there he quotes my former colleague at SI, Ben Ryder, famous now for his cover story on the Astros a couple years ago that said they would win in, you know, your 2017 world champion Houston Astros. And of course, Ben got deservedly lots of praise for that. But it speaks to the true ability that we have to know what's coming, that in that story, or maybe it was in a sidebar to that story, referring to Mark Appel, he referred to him as risk-free a pitching pick as you can find. That's not an exact quote, but it's pretty close to that. No, here it is. As risk-free a pitching pick as has ever been made. And that's not to focus on Ben, but it's to focus in on how much we can really project these guys going forward. And admits in the piece, if you want to call me the biggest prospect bust of all time, then go ahead. Maybe I really am.
He's not.
He's not, but at the same time, he's number one overall, and he would be. Now, he's had a number of injury issues. I think shoulder inflammation is the most recent one. He had some bone spurs removed, other stuff like that. But it just never worked out for him on the mound. He says, I've got a Stanford education. You know, I'm 26 years old. There are other things I can do with my life. I think he's, looking to go back to school and get a business degree and kind of go into finance or something like that. And maybe he'll get bit by the baseball bug again in a year or two. We don't really know. But if he never comes back, he will be just the third number one pick in history to never make the majors. And the other two were Steve Chilcott, who was the head scratcher of a first overall pick that the Mets made ahead of Reggie Jackson in the second draft ever. And then Brian Taylor, the Yankees prospect, who was pitching up to reputation until he got into this bar fight with his brother and ruined his arm. And two of those guys are pitchers, which might tell you something. And two of those pitchers dealt with injuries, but still over all those many years of the draft that we've had, it's 50 plus years of the draft. There have been three guys who haven't made the majors, so that's a pretty big bust. But it absolutely, there is no such thing as a pitching prospect, although there was some skepticism about Appel, I feel like, from the very beginning. I mean, again, you mentioned his prospect rankings, and they were high, but Baseball America, for a number one overall pick, Baseball America never got him above 31. There was a piece on Fangraphs recently by Carson Cistulli, where he looked at the overall performance of top 100 prospects compared to a thing he does every year called the Fringe Five, which are basically five guys who didn't make anybody's top 100 lists, but was just missed all of them, or like the next five guys in his estimation. And what he found was that the top 20 guys on those lists tend to do pretty well, but his Fringe Five over the years have done better on average than all the rest of them. So there's a theory there that these prospect lists are too long. In terms of predictability, it seems like things really start to fall off after that top 20. So you're talking about a guy who never really even made the top 20 on those lists, that the certainty about, or the confidence in his future performance may not have really been as strong as suggested by the fact that those lists go as deep as they do. And again, maybe those lists should not go that deep. 20 times 30 teams, we're talking about 600 players, not counting the fact that some of those organizations are much deeper than the others. And of course, you can have busts at number one too. I don't mean to pick on him in particular because he passed away recently, but Andy Marte is a guy that leaps to mind as having topped those lists year after year, and it just never worked out for him in the major leagues. You can't predict the future. You just can't predict the future. And with pitching prospects, that's doubly or maybe even triply true.
Baseball America in the magazine only goes 10 deep per team, but when they put out their annual book, they go 30 deep. And definitely with certain organizations that are thinner, they're obligated to find 30 guys. Look, nothing is saying that the rankings are perfectly rational. And when they say one guy is 25 and one guy is 30, you might as well put the names in a hat for all that difference matters. But you're ranking guys who may maybe be future utility players or middle relievers, but they, they have to do it. So if those guys
at the same time, if a guy makes the major leagues and sticks, even as a utility infielder or, the fourth guy on the fifth guy now, I guess, because bullpens are getting so deep up top. But, you know, on the bullpen depth chart, that's something. I mean, when talking about all of the minor leaguers out there, having a major league career of any length or even sticking as a marginal player is a significant accomplishment that guy probably deserved to be on one of those lists, considering they go that deep.
No, absolutely. It's just that we have to gauge our expectations appropriately and understand that, as you said, not every organization is equal, and that those guys, just because they're there, doesn't mean that they're future stars.
Yeah, and another, think about it mathematically again. Also, I said, you know, just going 20 deep, you've got 600, right? 600 prospects that you're listed. And you say in the Baseball America book, it's 30 deep, so now you're talking 900 prospects. Well, there are only, except for September, there are only 750 active players in the major leagues at any one time. And a prospect from, you know, draft or signing to reaching the major leagues is, what, maybe an average of 5 years? But a major league career, if you're a decent player, can be 10-plus. So you're not replacing those 750 major leaguers with those 900 prospects at the rate that would allow them to all graduate. It's a numbers game on some level. It's not going to happen. Yes, the next Clayton Kershaw has to come from somewhere. He's probably in the minors somewhere, or, you know, maybe he's going to be drafted this year, whatever it is. You know, the stars all come up from the minors, and so they were all some level of prospect at some point, even if it was a non-prospect because nobody appreciated what they could do. But not all those guys are going to make it up. There's just not room for them all. And then you get the guys who have the 15, 20-year careers. It's just not going to happen. So it's kind of mind-boggling to me that they – I mean, it's almost like covering your bases that, okay, if we're going to go 900 prospects deep so that we're not going to miss anybody, you know, and still most likely they will miss a few guys that have decent major league careers. So, yeah, again, and then I come back to that article by Carson where it's 20 guys every year that you can really say there's a very good chance that these guys are going to be legitimate quality. And even there, those guys, there's going to be a couple busts in that top 20, and there's going to be probably more guys that are, you know, league average inning eaters or just a league average starter that never makes a good team better. But that's something, and that's important. You know, I mean, the Josh Harrison level player or whatever, again, not to pick, I say not to pick on him a lot, but I don't want to pick on anybody in particular. I'm just using examples. You know, that is a significant level of success for a prospect. You know, you and every now and then, yes, you do get a Chris Bryant or a Carlos Correa, somebody who was ticketed for, I was going to say Bryce Harper, but not really even Bryce Harper. Yes, he had the remarkable MVP year, but he's been hurt more often than not. His career has been, on the whole, disappointing. As much as the talent is there and the major league career is there, and he's probably going to cash a gigantic contract in a year from now, regardless of what this market is doing, you know, it's not been what everybody's expected for him. It's so rare to find the guy that really, it's every step of the way, meets expectations straight on. You know, maybe Reggie Jackson, maybe Barry Bonds, those kind of guys. Ken Griffey. You know, we've got right now with the Hall of Fame, Chipper Jones is just the second number one pick going into the Hall of Fame. Now, right. Admittedly, the draft didn't come along until 65. So you really can't start thinking about, are these guys getting into the Hall of Fame, until the mid-90s, which is around the time that Reggie, who was in that second draft class, did go in. He was a number two pick, probably should have been a number one. But still, there's only two number one draft picks from, now we're talking the past 20 years, that it was possible have gone into the Hall of Fame. That tells you something about how dependable those rankings are in the long run.
I feel like I should challenge the Bryce Harper has been disappointing statement that you just made, and yet I don't feel that strongly about it, in that, I mean, look, on one hand, he's just finished his age 24 season, and he's career 285, 386, 515, and even though I just denigrated OPS, OPS plus a 140, that's a hell of a thing. At the same time, yes, a disproportionate part of it was that age 22, 2015 MVP season. And of six now major league seasons, he's really been fully healthy for two. And so, yeah, I can't argue that. The great thing is that being that he's only 25 this year, the best may still be yet to come.
That's certainly true, and his age is a major factor there. But at the same time, the fact that we're saying, the argument is, well, he's so young, he might get better, you know, is kind of evidence of my point. Yeah, I don't want to single out Bryce Harper, but no, I think based on his reputation as like the greatest prep player ever and a number one overall pick and a guy who came up at the age of 19. And yes, that's extremely young. But if you go back through history, you often find that some of the best players come up ahead of the other guys because it's this whole thing. The age is extremely important.
Right.
You know, the idea that a player who even in high school, it's like a matter of 6 months or something like that. Right. If you're 6 months younger than your average teammate or the average guy in your grade or class or whatever you want to call it, and you're better than everybody, then you're not just better than everybody. You are way better than everybody because you're, that 6 months of development time as a teenager is a significant difference in age. And, you know, that was kind of the factor. Rainey wrote a great article about this regarding Mike Trout. If Mike Trout was on the younger end of the aging curve, he was, I think, drafted at 17. You know, he was going to turn 18 soon. But the fact that he was as good as he was and was behind developmentally in terms of age was an indicator of how good he could be. And but at the same time, so you see these extremely talented players, whether it's Alex Rodriguez or Robin Yount or Ty Cobb or Mel Ott or just picking random guys, Mickey Mantle, whoever it is, they tend to come up young and be good fairly quickly. And Bryce Harper was on that path, but he's gotten hurt time and again. And I think injuries more than anything else is what has made him disappointing, but it still happened. And why, after 6 years, you expect something to change in terms of his health as he starts to get older? And again, older, he's going to be 25 this year. Older is in gigantic scare quotes, but you know, it's that idea of something's going to change. It's almost like Jason Hayward is kind of one of the exceptions to this rule, right? Because he came up very young, was good, and again, injuries kind of undermined him, but he never, whether it was because of the injuries, because supposedly he made a lot of adjustments to his swing as a result of those injuries, whether or not that is part of why he never really panned out the way people expected to as a hitter, it's impossible to say, really. Injuries played a part, and as he began to disappoint in subsequent years after that first year where he just missed being the Rookie of the Year because Buster Posey came on so strong late, you know, the idea of, well, he's so good, he came up so young, he's got so much ability, and he's been able to do so much so young that it's going to get better. And the Cubs bet big on that. And they got the defense, they got the value, and they won the World Series, and they got the big, you know, rah-rah speech, which apparently is very important. But he's just not that player. And I don't, at this point, I think it's safe to say he will never be that player. And Bryce Harper showed it to us for 1 year, and we know that when he's healthy, he can do it. But Nick Johnson, as thinking of Washington, springs to mind as a player who is constantly, if he's healthy, you know, Brett Saberhagen, whoever, the baseball is filled with extremely talented guys who would be in the Hall of Fame if they were healthy. And Bryce Harper, I'm afraid to say, looks right now like he's more on that track than on a different one.
I think, in fact, it was Bill James talking about maybe Barry Larkin, who said that staying healthy is a skill, just like other things in baseball, and some players don't have that skill, whether by chance they just happen to run into too many walls, or they don't have the judgment not to run into too many walls, or just genetically they're a little bit more frangible than the average cat. And, you know, the thing that I keep thinking about as you were saying this, and you pointed to this great Randy Jezzo-Yearly article from a number of years ago that observed this about the aging curve. It would seem to be obvious in a way, but he documented it. It wasn't obvious at the time. I'm not taking anything away from the article at all. It was, in its way, a seminal article, that the younger you get players, the more room for development they have. And I just keep thinking, this is going to sound facetious, but when these guys write about prospects and you get, you know, future grade on skills 20 to 80, and you'll see, you know, future hit tool, present 40, future 60, future speed, present 70, future 70, whatever. We really need pituitary gland is what we need. We need a 20 to 80 pituitary gland thing. And a Mike Trout, who's basically, you know, a 16-year-old playing with a bunch of guys who are going on 18, he gets a future pituitary rating of 80. And you know that this is a guy who has more room for growth because he's so darn young.
You know, that's actually, to detach slightly but stay within the Angels, that's one of the reasons I have so much optimism about Shohei Ohtani as a hitter. You know, I know there's some people who worry about strikeout rate or that he's got pop, but he's not necessarily a great hitter. Nori Aoki just signed a deal to go back to Japan for 3 years, and he'll probably stay there because he's in his mid-30s, and I can't see any reason why he would ever come back to the major leagues except as a coach or something, and even then, it would make more sense for him to stay in Japan. But by BWAR, by Baseball Reference's wins above replacement, he's the third most valuable non-pitcher born in Japan in major league history. You know, the success rate of Japanese-born hitters is just really low. There's Ichiro, who's going to waltz into the Hall of Fame deservedly, based just on what he did in the major leagues. There's Hideki Matsui, who was a solid player for some very good teams, won a World Series MVP. And then there's Aoki's number three. No, part of it is that nobody lasted that long, but nobody really had that much success.
And a lot of that is defense, too, because it's not like he was a major offensive player.
Right, exactly. He's kind of just a slap hitter and his defense was kind of hit and miss, too. And yeah, he added some with his legs. He stole a lot of bases in his first few years with the Brewers. But yeah, it's not I forget exactly. I think his career BWAR of something like 10, and that's third. Right. So there's not a lot of, you add that to the skepticism about, and of course, Japan now, since they went to the livelier ball, you know, the numbers there are kind of inflated. And there's a lot of skepticism about Ohtani as a hitter, but he's 23. And that's very, very different from every other Japanese player who's come to the major leagues. Those guys, Ichiro came over at 27. Some of those guys come over in their 30s, you know, whether they're posted. First off, other than Ichiro and I guess Matsui, there haven't been, maybe I shouldn't limit it that much, but there haven't been a lot of, you know, like we get with Tanaka or Yu Darvish, these kind of megastar hitters being posted. You know, there have been some hitters that are like, oh, that guy's an all-star in Japan, we should get him. But it's never been like, oh my gosh, it's, you know, the greatest hitter that Japan has to offer is coming over, I can't believe we're getting him in the major leagues. We haven't seen that very much. Sometimes it's guys who reach their natural free agency, which in Japan is I think 8 years, right? It's deeper into their career. So we've seen guys come over on the other side of the aging curve. We've never really seen a Japanese hitter come to the major leagues at that kind of Bryce Harper point. I mean, he's younger than Bryce Harper. He's going to be 23 this coming season. So I have optimism about his ability to continue to develop in the major leagues as a hitter. Now, certainly the amount of exposure he gets and, you know, the two-way thing contributes significantly to that potential. But I think because of his age, there is real potential there for him to continue to develop and kind of level up from Nippon Professional Baseball to the major leagues because of where he is on the development scale.
I just want to throw in to echo your point, because I was thinking of various Japanese-born players as you were listing them out, and guys who either were considered a little disappointing or had short-lived careers. And just to name two other guys, Kenji Jojima, the Mariners catcher, who was not bad for a couple of years, but he came over at 30. And catchers drop off fast. So yeah, he had a good age 30. He had a good age 31. Then nothing. Kosuke Fukudome with the Cubs, who had this huge contract and was considered a disappointment, again, was 31 that first year. So yeah, what do we expect? Of course he dropped off. So you're right that this is a, to invoke a cliche, whole new ballgame with Japanese imports. And you're right. There's, I mean, beyond just the novelty of everything that they're trying to attempt with Ohtani in terms of DHing on his off days and so forth, and going to a six-man rotation to accommodate that, there's a lot of distortion that's going into this that it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. But you're right, there's room for him to have a career and to make adjustments that these other guys just physically might not have been capable of doing.
It's one of the 9,000 reasons he's going to be interesting to watch over the next few seasons. Yeah, with this offseason having been so slow, I'm champing at the bit to see some, something I never thought I would say as recently as September, champing at the bit to see some Angels games this year.
Well, let's stick with a Japanese player for the moment, because another thing that's happening currently is that Yu Darvish is still on the market. Hell, everybody is still on the market. Name a player in baseball history. Grover Cleveland Alexander Cliff is still on the market, given this offseason that we're talking about having another homestead camp for free agents. But Yu Darvish has apparently expressed his desire to return to the Dodgers. And I know that he has had his injury concerns in the past, and he certainly didn't impress in the postseason, where he was either tipping his pitches or was just gassed. And of course, the Dodgers have the payroll from hell, so they're not exactly eager to add more salary. At the same time, when I look at their starting rotation, and I see penciled in right now Clayton Kershaw, Rich Hill, Alex Wood, Kenta Maeda, and Hyunjin Ryu, that's a great group. It's a very promising group. It's also a group where you could have all five starters on the disabled list at the same time.
Yeah, which I think they probably did at one point in the last year or two. I mean, the rate at which those guys hit the DL. Yeah, the Darvish is a very interesting case. He supposedly has expressed interest to return to the Dodgers. I've also seen reports that he's waiting for the Dodgers or Yankees to clear luxury tax money, to clear salary in order to sign him. Now, to me, that translates as he's waiting for the Yankees or Dodgers to start bidding so that the Brewers or the Twins have to pay more. Whether or not the Brewers or Twins will, the Brewers have said that they have room in their budget to sign one more big guy, and I think they'd like it to be a pitcher. I think they've been aggressive on Darvish. The Twins came into the offseason saying we have money to spend on pitchers and we want to go to the top of the market, and they really haven't done much. But Darvish is a guy who's been on their list in the beginning for obvious reasons. So I think there's more market out there for Darvish than just the Dodgers. And like you say, the Dodgers have a lot of depth, but at the same time, a lot of uncertainty. You know, they didn't have the only pitcher who qualified for the ERA title for the Dodgers last year was Kershaw, who we all know was hurt for a significant portion of the season, made 27 starts. So, and he's been hurt more often than not recently. That's the other thing. He's now going into his age 30 season, and I think three of the last 4 years, he's spent some time on the DL. So he's not a guy as great as he is when he's healthy, and he is, you know, when healthy, the best per-inning pitcher, starting pitcher in the major leagues still. He's not a guy you can count on for 30 starts and 200 innings anymore. Whether or not that's... And there were some other negative indicators with him this past year in terms of some of his rates starting to decline, partially because they were so absurdly high before. But so that's Kershaw. And then things go, as you go down the list, Rich Hill's going into his age 38 season. You know, Alex Wood came out of the bullpen last year and had a fantastic season. I don't think he's going to repeat it. He's always had good peripherals, so he could be a solid, better than league average pitcher. But again, some injury issues. He seemed to lose velocity, not seemed to. He did lose velocity late in the season. Ryu actually, to some degree, I think it's underappreciated the fact that he made 24 starts last year after a couple years worth of injury issues, you know, because he wasn't on the postseason roster, but a pretty good comeback for him, but a high home run rate and his reserved run average was not encouraging. They added Tom Kohler, who bounced around after leaving the Marlins. He's not anything special, but they have depth there. And they also have one of those pitching prospect guys we were talking about before, and Walker Buehler, who's right, a 23-year-old who pitched very bad, poorly out of the bullpen late last year, but is still considered, you know, the potential there very high. But he's a guy who had Tommy John surgery a few years ago and hasn't really been stretched out. And, you know, I mean, maybe you can get 15 major league starts out of him this year if he's effective. They have a lot of depth, but there's a lot of uncertainty. And adding Darvish would make a certain amount of sense. But as slow as this market has been, and as much as today is February 1st that we're recording this, and we're still talking about, I mean, the list of free agents that are still out there, Darvish, Arrieta, Alex Cobb, Lance Lynn. I mean, right there, that's four of the top five starting pitching. You know, Greg Holland's still out there. Eric Hosmer's still out there. Logan Morrison, Lucas Duda. I can keep going. Neil Walker. It's insane. JD Martinez. It's insane to list the people who are still out there, but I feel like of all of those, I feel like Darvish might be the closest to signing, or certainly there's been the most noise and rumors and from Darvish himself about him. I feel like of all those guys, he's the one I'm least worried about having a team when pitchers and catchers report.
And just one more exclamation point, both Dodgers-wise and relevant to what we were saying before about how there is no such thing as a pitching prospect. Julio Urias, only 21 this season. You may not see him this year. You didn't see him a lot last year. But in 2016, he came up at age 19, put up a 3.39 ERA in 77 innings, struck out almost 10 batters per nine. Wow, that's incredible. That looked like the beginning of a great career. Last year, he got hit around some. Turned out he needed shoulder surgery. Whereas we've come a long, long way on Tommy John surgeries and the predictability of guys coming back from elbow operations, shoulders are still a reason to feel really, really panicky about what a pitcher's future is. We won't know about Urias for a while if he's going to be the same major league pitcher, if he's going to be a pitcher at all. And you won't see him represented on, I don't know if he's still eligible for prospect lists, given his major league service time. No, he's not, because he did exceed his rookie status. But still, you're not going to see him mentioned because there's zero reason to count on him right now. So that's really a top-level prospect who just got shuffled right off the deck, so to speak.
And worse than shoulder surgery, it's anterior capsule surgery in his pitching shoulder. Capsule injuries are devastating to pitchers from what I've observed. The two guys that jump to mind when it comes to that are Chin-Ming Wong, whose career was not ended because he had the little comeback with the Royals a year or two ago, but effectively his career was ended by a capsule injury, and Johan Santana, who just fell off, I think unjustly fell off the Hall of Fame ballot this year. It was an anterior, I don't know if it was anterior or posterior, but it was a capsule injury in his shoulder. That's an injury that pitchers don't tend to come back from at all in terms of major league production. And so you're talking about a guy who had the entire world in front of him in terms of being one of the best pitching prospects in the game, young, ahead of things, a Mexican-born pitcher in the Dodgers system. You know, there were all these comparisons, not necessarily physically, but just, you know, here's a Mexican lefty coming up at 19 for the Dodgers. You know, people think about Fernando Valenzuela and just the amount of excitement around this kid. And it's just devastating to see this specific injury derail his career, because it could very realistically completely derail his career. Whether or not we'll see Julio Urias have anything much more than a cameo in the major leagues going forward, I have no idea. But he's off the map, I think, for all of this year and maybe part of next year.
One other note that is Dodgers-related, Dodgers-adjacent, and our hour has flown by, and as always, I appreciate our getting the chance to spend the time together. There was a note on Hardball Talk today that Davey Lopes, who's been a manager and a coach basically continually since about 1992, is retiring. He's going to go home. And he had such a wonderful career, and I'm not just talking about the sideline stuff that he did, but as a player. And he was part of a rather unique moment in Dodgers history, in that the Dodgers at that time were pumping out more prospects than they could profitably use. And so they would just stick them wherever. And two of those guys who got stuck wherever and became the double play combination were Davey Lopes, who was an outfielder in the minor leagues. And they said, well, we need a second baseman. Voila, you're a second baseman. And they did the same thing with Bill Russell, who was an outfielder. And they said, we need a shortstop. We don't have that Maury Wills guy anymore, or whoever they were using at that point. I think it was Maury Wills. And they said, ta-da, you're a shortstop. And he played as many games as anybody ever, basically, at shortstop. I mean, not first all time, but he's high up on the list. And they went to the playoffs with that group, which also included Steve Garvey and Ron Say at the corners, four times. And no, those guys were not Gold Glove infielders by any means, but it was good enough. And they did enough with the bat. And Lopes was one of the great percentage base stealers of all time. He had power. He had patience. I mean, pretty much the quintessential leadoff hitter, Davey Lopes. And it seems to me, well, one, I should note that strategy hit a wall with Pedro Guerrero, who was also a first baseman, and they said, you're an outfielder. No, you're a third baseman. And it turned out he really was a toaster. He wasn't anything at all. He was one of the great hitters, right-handed hitters of all time, but there was no position for him. So that strategy died there. But I wonder if we'll ever see that again, because there's a certain utility, obviously, in just saying, we're going to put a guy where we need a guy. And I wonder now if, with the added emphasis on defense, with our better being able to quantify just how valuable it is for guys to be able to get balls in play, if we will ever see that kind of whimsy again.
Well, you could argue that Daniel Murphy playing second base is exactly that kind of whimsy. I think on some level you will. I think certainly teams are willing to try that in the minor leagues. You know, I saw somebody, I think it was just plain speculation or just throwing a theory at the wall that the Brewers should try Ryan Braun. Now that they've signed Lorenzo Cain and traded for Christian Yelich, that the Brewers should try Ryan Braun at second base. he came up as a bad third baseman, and now he's, you know, 10, 15 years later, I don't think he's going to be a second baseman. I don't think that sort of thing is going to happen. But yeah, I think we'll see that, you know, on occasion here and there. You know, the thing that we see more often now is we see the switch between hitting and pitching, where, you know, if a prospect, Sean Doolittle's and Kenley Jansen are two excellent examples, but we've seen a few guys go the other way as well. That sort of, what can we do with this guy? We've got a talented athlete on our hands. What can we do with him? Where does he fit? What does he do? Having that level of flexibility, and now the Rays have a player in their minor league system who they're letting play two-way, and you've got Otani, who's going to try to play two-way in the major leagues, and I think has a good chance of success there. But in terms of, you know, throwing a guy wherever he fits on, you know, on the diamond, the one trick there is that the Lopes and Russell situation was pre-free agency, though, so there was more of a self-determination in terms of the teams knowing where they would have a hole. You know, they could kind of control, we're going to hold on to this guy until this guy is ready. We're going to see if he can play second, he can play short, whatever, and then we can move those guys and bring these guys up. And of course, that went away almost immediately after those guys reached the major leagues. I think 1973 was the first year of the longest running infield of those four guys you mentioned, who played together for 9 years before Lopes left as a free agent. Or no, he was traded to Oakland, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, but I think you're onto something there with those decisions about moving those players being made before free agency. Because at that point, if you had a hole and you couldn't arrange a trade for, I don't know, Bert Campanaris or something, you didn't have a shortstop. You had to manufacture one yourself. And if your only other alternative, your in-house alternative, was at replacement level, what the heck? Try Bill Russell.
I think that sort of flexibility still exists. Again, we talked about prospects before. The focus on prospects, I think, sometimes can put the increased focus on prospects that we have today, particularly with all the publications dedicated to them and all the articles and rankings and lists, can put some pressure on a team not to mess up a prospect by making that kind of move. But sometimes it's called for. But I feel like teams in the minor leagues now focus more on what's best for the player and then worry about how he fits on the roster when he gets to the majors. But I still think that in certain situations, that flexibility will exist. And what we're seeing actually with a lot of teams, and I think the Astros and the Cubs are examples of this, are teams that say, hey, let's try to have this guy is not going to, you know, he's not going to be Mike Trout at his given position. But if he can play four or five positions, you know, if he can be Marwin Gonzalez or Ben Zobrist or whatever it is, or even Chris Bryant. I mean, Chris Bryant is Chris Bryant, right? He's got an MVP under his belt, but they've played him at shortstop, you know, in center field, and that kind of flexibility because of, you know, how many pitchers are being put on the roster and how thin the benches are. Maybe not necessarily taking one guy and saying you're a shortstop now, but saying like, dude, if you could just play a game or two at shortstop for us when we need it, if you could, you know, stand in center field for a game or two when we've got a ground baller on the mound. Flexibility in that way, I think, is becoming a larger emphasis within the
I think
league.
That's an underrated aspect of things. One place where I really admired what Davey Johnson did with the Mets was that Howard Johnson was a pretty awful third baseman, and in no way would you think of him as somebody who, hey, maybe he could cover short. But if Sid Fernandez was on the mound, and Sid Fernandez was a power lefty who only gave up fly balls, literally had games where there were zero ground balls in the game. It was all strikeouts, pop-ups, and fly balls. why not put Howard Johnson at shortstop? Why not put a duck at shortstop? He's not going to see any balls. So you could get, instead of having some weak bat, some light-hitting shortstop, you could have Howard Johnson, who's a 30-homer guy there, and plug in somebody who has a third baseman's bat at third. And, you know, you take your chances that if there is one ball that happens to get pulled to short off of Cid Fernandez, that, you know, maybe it'll be hit right at Howard Johnson. It'll be okay. And I haven't researched it that I know that that never cost them a game, but I do not recall an example of when that cost them a game. And whereas not every pitcher is as extreme as Cid Fernandez, I think there are probably more opportunities like that available.
Absolutely. It's a different kind of platoon, you know, and that's the kind of thing that it's harder for us to see in the game logs because, you know, we can see righty lefty. That stuff is all indicated, you know, in the kind of like baseball reference game logs and that kind of stuff. But there aren't little notations for ground ball or fly ball or this guy tends to everybody pulls this guy's stuff, that kind of stuff. We don't see that. So there are other ways to platoon players. It can be, you know, the opposing pitcher is a curveball artist. This guy can't hit the curve or, you know, whatever, that kind of stuff, which can factor into a manager's decisions. And of course, the other trick is that those things can sometimes overlap. Is you can say, okay, we've got a fly baller on the mound, so let's put our, you know, our guy who stands at third base at third base, but the other guy is, you know, throws this nasty slider he can't hit, and then, you know, and then you get righty lefty considerations and all sorts of other things. So there's a lot of factors that go into each of these decisions, but I think absolutely there, and I think some of that is, like I say, things that you've seen some of these teams do in recent years with, for example, Chris Bryant playing center field when there's Kyle Hendricks on the mound or something like that. So we have been seeing that, but it's been less obvious to us. And I think I'm really on some level, maybe it's our job to point that out more often when it happens or to suggest it more often when we see an opportunity for it. But it is a compelling aspect of player usage.
Just to put a button on what we were saying on Davey Lopes and the Dodgers infield and stuff, you pointed out about guys who go from third to first. That was what Garvey did. Garvey came up as a third baseman. He couldn't play that position, and Ron Say, who was actually pretty good, was coming up behind him, so he moved over to first. That bumped Bill Buckner to the outfield, and Bill Buckner was a guy who had no knees at all for the entire conscious existence of my life, so it's very hard for me to visualize him in the outfield, but that's what he did for the Dodgers for many years prior to going on to glory with the Red Sox and other teams. But I just wanted to share this neat, I collect platoon seasons, and this is another thing that with the growth of bullpens are kind of extinct. But at the end of his career, Davey Lopes went over to the Cubs, and he was there from ages 39 through 41. So we're talking about a really elderly guy. He was just a bench guy. He was not a full-time second baseman. He played the outfield. He played third. He played basically, he was Ben Zobrist Mark One. He got, in those three seasons, one full season of play, if you add them all up. He hit in 539 plate appearances, 287, with a 398 on base and a 454 slugging. He hit 17 home runs, drew 83 walks, and stole, ready for this, 67 bases in 77 opportunities. Again, the man was in his 40s.
It's remarkable. He stole 47 bases in his age 40 season in 99 games. He set a record, I think it was the next year when he stole 25 bases at the age of 41. For the most stolen bases at that age or something like that. It was unprecedented, the rate at which he was swiping bags at that age. Of course, that was the really kind of the peak of the stolen base. You know, that was the Vince Coleman and Ricky Henderson years when everybody was running. But he was stealing at a high percentage still. You know, I mean, just a fantastic player, very exciting. You know, I missed his prime with the Dodgers, but certainly I've watched a lot of those games retroactively going back and watching the 1977 World Series, for example, or other such things. You know, tons of respect for Davey Lopes, and I wish him well in retirement.
Definitely. Happy retirement to Davey Lopes. And Cliff, happy retirement to us, at least just for today. We have come to the end of our time together. Thank you for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Steve. Always fun.
By Satan's bony shrimp fork, we have reached the end of another episode. To follow Cliff on Twitter, go to @CliffCorcoran. You can't miss it. And to follow me, try @ go Stephen Goldman. Why go Stephen Goldman? Because the account for Glow Stephen Goldman was taken by a Jewish firefly. You can also write us at infiniteinning@gmail.com. And please, please, please rate us at iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcatcher of your choice. It helps so much. We have a sponsor now, but nevertheless, this episode is brought to you by the number 15. Our producer is Flaubert Pimchuk. Our theme song, which you are hearing now and have been listening to throughout the episode, was co-written by myself and Dr. Rick Mooring. When we were in high school, in gym class, Rick and I frequently had to run this mile-and-a-half unpaved dirt track called the Fitness Trail, which wound between trees, through gullies, over hills, and past the occasional slowly waving animatronic gopher. Rick would complete this task in about 3.5 minutes. I would complete it in about 3.5 hours and require the assistance of a paramedic. He seemed very happy with himself at those times, and so it never occurred to me to feel hurt that he was making me look bad. Well, if Bud Selig doesn't come out of retirement and thump me with his umbrella, I'll be back next week with more tales and discussion from inside the Infinite Inning.